The next piece I want to look at in this whole process really kind of digs back to the first sugya that we did in a way, which is Rabbi Eliezer and Tanur Shel Achnoi, which I suggested was really a description of the transformation from Torah being a prophetic tradition to being an legislative process of argumentation and persuasion and ultimately of a vote. So we have this Breito, which we're talking the first Breito we're going to do very quickly, because you'll see it kind of runs in a pattern. The pattern, you could sort of see the scaffolding. And our main purpose is really to get to the end. So now, Tanya, the sugya in Sanhedrin, and the context in Sanhedrin is in the rules of Zaken Mamre. Right, Zaken Mamre is halacha in the Torah of an elder, a member of the Beit Din, who has been outvoted on something, and nonetheless, subsequently, goes back to his town and instructs the people to do it his way. In other words, he doesn't accept the authority of the Beit Din. It's Chayav Mitah. A lot of his thing, details of the halachot, under what circumstances he's considered a Zaken Mamre. A Zaken Mamre only exists, of course, with the Beit Din HaGadol Shel Yerushalayim. So in that context, we have the following braita. Tanya. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Mitchila lo hayu mrabin machloket b'Yisrael. Now, important to remember that Rabbi Yossi is considered, as one of my teachers calls it, the historian of the Chachamim. He really is the historian among them. We see that in all sorts of places, including the fact that Rabbi Yossi is the one who's credited with being the author of Midrash Seder Olam, which is a chronology going back from creation all the way until the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And so he tells the following story. Now, Rabbi Yossi, important to note, lived in the 2nd century, died, as far as I know, at the end of the 2nd century, right? And was a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva of the later years. He was one of those later students, and was the leading of the leading foursome. You know, the foursome of the Mishnah, the most famous foursome we have in the Mishnah, are Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Shimon. And those four together, Rabbi Yossi is considered to be the elite, such that if Rabbi Yossi disagrees with any one of the others, and we have no other evidence going one way or the other, then the halacha follows him. Rabbi Yossi nimukoyimo. So Rabbi Yossi says the following thing. Originally, there were not a lot of machlokot. Now, what leads to machloket? Why is there machloket?
Two reasons.
Yeah.
So one is because we're trying to figure out what Hashem wants.
I know, but okay. But what's missing? What is it that leads there to be a difference of opinion or a dispute about halacha that we call machloket?
Time, mesorah.
Meaning what?
That there was originally one understanding of application and it gets misconstrued or distorted over time.
Okay, so Jeff's suggesting, first of all, that machloket happens because of a forgetting or a loss of tradition, and then an attempt to reconstruct the tradition. We have disagreements either about what the tradition was, I heard it this way, you heard it that way, or yeah, lacking any evidence, how to reconstruct it. Okay, why else might there be machloket?
New situations arise.
Exactly, new situations arise, and you have different perspectives on how to address them. Now, in the piece we did last week, if you remember, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's last drasha was, a person walks into the Beit Midrash and hears halal metamin, halal metarin, halal postin, halal machshirin, etc., and a person says, Heyach ani lamei Torah miata, how could I possibly study Torah with all of these different opinions? And therefore, afata ase oznecha ka'afar keset, make your ears like a funnel, like a hopper, and find a way, acquire the intellectual sophistication and maturity to be able to understand the approaches of each position, right? Of opposite positions. All right, that's one take. And it makes it sound as if the ideal position in Torah is to be someone who has intellectual gymnastic ability to be able to deal with both approaches and see the validity of each approach. It's not the only voice. So here we have the statement, Lo hayu marbin machloket b'Yisrael. So I asked what leads to machloket. So correct, it either is because an attempt to reconstruct what's been lost or an attempt to apply something to something new. But if you think about it, what leads to machloket ultimately is lack of authority. It goes, why is there machloket? It's machloket because there is no one body, person or group, that when it issues a ruling, that's the end of the road. Because if it were the case, there wouldn't be machloket. And that's what Rav Yossi is kicking into, as you'll see. Ella, Beit Din shel 71 yoshvim lishkat hagazit. Lishkat hagazit literally means the office of the hewn stone. It's called that because, famously, you're not allowed to hew the stones of the Mizbeach. Right, that's in the Torah, and so when they built an office in the Azara for the Sanhedrin, that had hewn stones. It's not in the Lishkat HaGazit, the office of the hewn stone. It's in the Azara. There's an interesting diyun in Masachet Sanhedrin about where it was, because you're not allowed to sit in the Azara. So, but that's where the Supreme Court of 71 sat. Right. There were two courts of the next number down, which is 23. They're both on Har Habayit, and one of them is on the entrance to Har Habayit, which means when you come up to Har Habayit, there's a wall around Har Habayit that borders it off, saying, you know, if you are a if you are a Zav, you can't go up here, Har Habayit. Then there was a Beit Din that sat in front of that, and one that sat in front of the Azara. Azara, which is further in the courtyard. Ushar batei dinim shel 23 yoshvim b'chol ha'erot Yisrael. Throughout the country, there were courts of 23. Hutzrach ha'davar lishol. Now let's go out to the hinterland. A question needed to be asked. Sho'alim b'Beit Din shaviran. You'd go to your local Beit Din and ask them, what's the halakha? Okay? Now watch. And this is where things are very different than what we're accustomed to. Because what do we do? We have a question. We ask our local Orthodox rabbi. What does our LOR say? What does he say? Ask question.
Let me ask mine.
No. Typically, what is that? That's not true.
I'll get back.
That's secondary. Well, first, usually the first thing is he gives you an answer. And if you were to ask him, where'd you get it from? He would say, it's the Shach in Yaradea. In other words, he would quote a source.
Is that what you did? You ask where you got it from?
No, I'm saying if you were to ask. If you were to ask, where'd you get it from? Like, that would happen, I'll tell you where it would happen, is if a congregant or someone would call the rabbi and say, my son, who just came back to me, she was pestering me about, so tell me, please tell me where you got it from so I could show him that it's legit. Right? Unfortunately, but that's kind of where things are at. I say unfortunately only because of the lack of kavod involved in that approach, but it is real. But if you were to ask him where he got it from, it wouldn't be that, well, I sat and I thought about it in the split second since you asked me, and I reasoned as follows. He would quote a source, right? I ask questions all the time. I did a wedding on Sunday. I don't do weddings very often, so I had a lot of questions. I asked Rabbi Muskin through all the questions, and almost every one of them, he had answers right away, because he does weddings all the time. He knows this. He's looked it up, and if I were to ask him, I wouldn't, but if I were to ask him, where'd you get it from, he would tell me what the source is and everything. A couple things we had on this wedding that were unusual. And so I asked him, and so what was the next approach? If he doesn't say, here's the answer, what's his next approach? Let me look into it. And let me look into it means one of two things. Let me think about it, or let me ask somebody else. Right? So we had a particular situation, which he had not been faced with before, and didn't want to take to shoulder the responsibility. So he asked somebody else and passed that answer on to me, and that's what we did. Right? However, you notice that the system consistently is that you ask somebody either what they know, or they take it to somebody else who does know, and it's always relying on source material. Now, watch what happens here. Utsracha davar lishol. If a question came up, sho'alim beit din shabiran, you would come to the local beit din and ask them. Im shamu amru lahen. What does that mean? That means if that Beit Din had already heard what the halakha was, then they would tell them. Meaning, how did that Beit Din know the halakha? Because they'd heard it. From whom? From their teachers. In other words, it was part of a Masorah already. And they would say, yes, 5 years ago we had a case like this, and our teacher ruled the following, based on a Masorah, and that's what we would tell. Vim lav, but in the very highly likely circumstance where they had not heard an answer to the particular question, you would think the next thing they would do is they would sit and debate it. This is a Beit Din. Va'in l'zeshem samuch liran. They'd go to the next town. So you went to Afula, and the Beit Din and Afula had heard, they'd tell you what to do. If they said, we don't know, they'd get together and they would go to Beit Shan. Who would go to Beit Shan? 23 guys from Afula, and by the way, you and your opposite number, if it was a litigation, from Gilboa, and you'd go all together to Beit Shan. Im Shamu Amru Lahem. Now, by the way, the Beit Din's getting crowded now. If the Beit Din and Beit Shan had heard, they would tell them, Im Lav, now what? Va'in Lezeh Shal Petach Harabayit. The whole group, all of them would get together, go to Yerushalayim, and they'd go to the 23 that are sitting outside Harabayit. Im Shamu Amru Lahem. Again, if that Beit Din had heard, then they would tell them, Vim Lav, Va'in Lezeh Shal Petach Azarav. They'd come to the next one that's on the door of the Azarav. V'yomer Kach Darashti, V'kach Darshu Chaviray. Which means that what we are talking about is a dispute among Chachamim way back originally in the first step, and there was no resolution. And so these two would then come to the local Beit Din. If the Beit Din didn't have Masorah, they'd move to the next Beit Din. Beit Din didn't have Masorah, move to the next Beit Din. They'd finally come to the Beit Din HaPetach HaZarah, right? And each one would say, this is how I interpreted it, and that's how they interpreted it. In other words, they present the two questions, two issues. Im Shamu Amru Lahem. If that Beit Din had heard, they would tell them. V'im Lav. If not. And you think about, from a perspective of contemporary law, what a paralysis the system is. Eilu Ba'ilu Ba'in Lishkat HaGazit. They all go up to Lishkat HaGazit. So you can imagine, you've got a couple hundred people here, Dayanim, at least 100 people, Dayanim and the parties, and we assume there's probably lots of onlookers who come to Lishkat HaGazit.
The Beit Din goes each time.
Each Beit Din moves with the group that's asking, and they move to the next one, because then what will happen next time? They'll be able to say Shamanu, right?
How many times?
Shisham.
Do they do this?
I have no idea. We don't know if it ever happened. This is we'll see. Shisham. What?
It's kind of similar to Parshas Yitro.
Not really, because in Parshat Yitro, it's a numerical hierarchy. Here, they're all 23, right? Here, it's a regional issue, right? And the notion is that the more central the Beit Din, the more tradition they will have. And therefore, you start with the Beit Din in your city. They might have heard, but another Beit Din might have. If not, then you go to Yerushalayim, and you go in. But let's say nobody had. Let's say it's a new circumstance. Suddenly, the Romans are coming through towns, and they're pillaging and everything else. And you went to sleep at night and you had 5 wine barrels in your storehouse. The Romans went into the storehouse, stayed the night there, left the next morning, and the wine barrels were still sealed. Can you drink them or not? We never had this before, right? The halacha boleshet. Right? So we have to know what to do. So what would happen? Imlav elu elu bayin lishkat hakazit. The whole group would come into lishkat hakazit. Shesham yoshvin mitamit shel shachar tamit shel ben arbayim. The Beit Din HaGadol sits from the Korban Tamid of the morning, which means dawn, maybe perhaps even before dawn, all the way until the afternoon Tamid, what we call Mincha, but the afternoon Tamid, right? And Uviyami, Uvi Shabbatot, Uviyami Tovim, Yashvim Machil. On Shabbat and Yom Tov, they sit outside. In the ramparts, they don't sit inside. Nishalash Shelah B'fneihem. And then the question will be posed. Im Shamu Amru Lahem. Again, if they had the Masorah, that would be easy. Vim Lav, Omdim L'minyan. What does that mean? They'd immediately take account. Now, what's missing from here, we have to sort of assume, is they would then discuss it and debate it and bring sources and go through the process, unless possibly not. Maybe they would just say, what do you think the halakha is?
Is that's the kind of, visiting base in the part of the
what?
Count?
What?
The visiting base.
No, only the 71. Good question. Only the 71 is part of the count.
Why, do they all have, why can't they just like write a letter?
Because then it's not Shamu. Exactly. This is all Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? And so therefore, I was there, you know, you're going to say, 20 years later, I was there, or better yet, 60 years later, you're going to say, my father was there as part of the Beit Din, and he heard when they paskin that Yayin Akum is Asur, right? Or whatever it is, and therefore I can give testimony that this is the case, and now it's part of the Masorah. But notice that the entire legal system is working on a tradition of transmission, and at no point in this process is there a procedural system built in for discussion, for debate, for persuasion, etc.? And Rabbi Yossi is describing this in nostalgic terms. Now, there's one point critical to make that we've talked about in all different contexts, a lot of different contexts in the past, is we have numerous examples of historic narratives about the rabbinic and pre-rabbinic period, the Mikdash period. And you always have to ask the question, well, who is telling the story, and when are we hearing the story? So if you heard a story, for instance, of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, better yet, Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, or his son, Shimon Gamliel, or Rebbe, about the Beit HaMikdash. So you have a couple questions to ask. Rebbe never saw the Beit HaMikdash. Right? He was born too late. So how did Rebbe know this information? So he had some sort of Masorah. And now, where did we get it from Rebbe? Meaning, Rebbe Yehuda Rasi told it at some point, and somebody then passed it on. And ultimately it's Amar Zesh, Amar Zesh, Amar Zesh, Amar Zesh, Amar Rebbe, you know, that we have. So you always have to wonder how much of the description is historic narrative and how much of it is idyllic, idyllic sort of nostalgia. And the best example of that is the third parak of, the truth is we have a lot, and Masachat Tamid is a good example of that. But is the third parak of Masachat Bikurim. Third parak of Masachat Bikurim describes the whole procedure, bringing the Bikurim from the local farm all the way till coming in the basket and everything else. And the question is this an eyewitness narrative, or is it sort of an idyllic image? I mean, the procession is gorgeous, fantastic, and hard to believe that in the waning years of the Mikdash, anybody had the wherewithal or even the yishuv adat, how do you say yishuv adat, sort of calmness of mind, right?
Strength of mind.
Strength of mind or calmness of mind, whatever it is.
Settle
what?
Mind.
Settle in mind, whatever you'd call it, sort of a sense of equanimity, to be able to do something like that, considering all that was going on. I don't know. So we don't know if what Rosiozzi is describing is some sort of a tradition that he had going back 150 years or so as to how things operated. Actually, more than that, you'll see, probably about 200 years. Or is it an image of what it should have been like? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. But take a look at this. Im lav omdim leminyan. If the Beit Din HaGadol had not heard a tradition about this, then they count. And again, what does that mean? Does it mean they right away take account, or do they debate it and persuade and try to convince people to come over to their side, etc., and then finally take account? And then, of course, whatever the majority is, that's the halakha, which means, by the way, ein machloket b'Yisrael. Because if the question is that when a person is modu b'miktzat, do they have to take a shua on the rest, but the part that they were moda on was something that we have aid him for, whatever it might be, then either they heard the tradition, that's the halakha, or they didn't, in which case, we don't have a halakha, we keep moving, and we keep moving up, and if we get to the highest court in the land and nobody has a tradition, then they take a vote, and whatever 36 out of 71 or more say, that's the halakha. See, there is no such thing as Zeh Omer v'Zeh Omer. Zeh Omer v'Zeh Omer is only within the bubble of the Beit Din, which once you leave the Beit Din doesn't exist anymore. That's what Yossi is describing. Now watch where Rabbi Yossi, this whole description is leading to. And this is, I think, his main point. He says, Rabu ha-metam'im tam'utimu, Rabu ha-metarim ta'aru. That's just what counting is. If there's more people who say tahor, it's tahor. The more people say tamei, it's tamei. All right, it's very straightforward. And then he has this line. Mishirabu talmidei shamai v'hilel. Shaloshim shu kol tzarkan. So you have now an explosion, a lot of students of Hillel and Shammai, what we call Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, who did not, were not diligent enough in their studies. That's the best way to translate. Shloshim shu kol tzarkan. They didn't serve their masters well enough, which means they weren't diligent enough in study. Rabu machloket b'Yisrael. Suddenly, there's more machlokot b'Yisrael. Because, by the way, if you open up the corpus of the Mishnah, what do you find starting from the very first Mishnah? The first Mishnah asks, when do we say Kriyat Shema and Arvit? And until when can we say it? And we've already got three opinions. Right? And then, the next one, until when can you say Kriyat Shema in the morning? You got two opinions there. And from when? You got two opinions there. And the Mishnah doesn't degrade one, or discard, should we say, one opinion as saying, well, somebody said this, but it's not. It presents it as if, okay, we got these different opinions here. And in very few cases does the Mishnah itself say, Halacha X. We have that, for instance, in Peah. We have four different opinions about how much land you have to own. We talked about this in the context of the Shchivim on the Puzzle, of how much land you have to own to be considered a landowner for certain things. Right? And Rabbi Kiva says, Karka kol shulchev, the opinion before him is k'deli tzor v'shnot v'halakha kidvarav. How often in the Mishnah do you see the Mishnah ruling what halakha is? And so Rabbi Yossi is saying, so take a look at it. Suddenly we have machloka b'Yisrael. Now what's the reason that yesh machloka b'Yisrael? In other words, what's missing that Rabbi Yossi is turning the contemporary situation into a bad turn relative to the good old days? So what's the last line? Rabu machloka b'Yisrael v'nasei torah k'shtei torot. There's no way in the world Rabbi Yossi means this in a good way. There's no way in the world Rabbi Yossi says that the Torah now looks like two Torot, and what a great thing that is. He clearly means it pejoratively. And who is he blaming for that event, for the series of events that led to the fact that Torah looks like two Torot? He said, the Talmidei Shammai Rehillel, that didn't study diligently enough. But is that really the problem? What was the problem with... What was the upside of what existed before? Is that you had a system that everybody respected, and that there was a hierarchy, and the only way halakha was ever determined was based on tradition. And then as you move further up, if at the final poll that you got to there was no tradition, then they would discuss it, come to a decision, and it was one decision, and there's no machloket. Now the reality is that if you look through the text of the Tanaitic literature, you will find very few machlokot that go before the era of Hillel and Shammai. Very few. As a matter of fact, there's only one. It's the most famous one. It's a Mishnah in Chagiga. What is the Mishnah in Chagiga? It has the famous machloket about smicha on a korban on yontif. And the machloket goes back to the zugot. Remember the zugot? We know them from Pirkei Avot. Yosef ben Yochanan, Yosef ben Yoezer, right? Nitai Har Bailey. Yeshua ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai, that whole series of zugot, and in each generation, one opinion said lismoch, one said not lismoch, until finally it was Hillel and Menachem leaves and Shammai takes his place. I have this machloket, but it's like the one machloket that existed in halacha. That's the way it's described, at least. Were there other differences of opinion? There certainly were. Were there differences of opinion on how to relate to the Hasmonean kings? Certainly were. But machloket and halacha. So Rabbi Yossi is now pinning the blame and saying that we have the students of Hillel and Shammai who did not study diligently enough, and as a result of that, suddenly it looks like we have two Torot. But the two don't really hook up. The statement doesn't hook up. Because what's Rabbi Yossi crediting for the fact that there was one Torah? The fact that there was a universally recognized system where ultimately there was a Beit Din HaGadol that would make a decision, and that was it. And anything lower than that could never make its own decision, could only transmit tradition. Right? So, and suddenly what do we have? We have students who weren't diligent enough. As a result of that, we have what looks like two Torot. And it's true. If you were to spend a week as a total Beit Shammai, I'm not advocating this at all, right? Because it's awesome. But if you were to spend a week as a total Beit Shammai guy and another week as a total Beit Hillel guy, you would have had two very different weeks. And I don't just mean what bracha would you make at Kiddush first and what your tzitzis would look like. Your Shabbos would look different. Lots of things would look very different. So Rabbi Yossi, who's clearly seeing this as a negative thing, says that we've at the basically the turn of the millennium, because that's Beit Shammai Hillel is around the year zero or so, 10, suddenly we've gotten to a point where there are like two schools that hold their positions, and what's the problem? What's missing? What did we have back then? What we had back then was a universally recognized authority that had the final say, and whatever they said, that was the halakha, no matter how I feel about it. And now there was a different kind of position, which leads, and that statement itself is kind of murky as to what the problem is, which is why I want to show you this next statement from Masechet Eruvin.
I have a general question.
Yeah.
The goal of education is to educate you so that you can try to make the right decisions. If you're traveling, you're a merchant or something, and you're not in the community for a while, and questions come up, you know, you want to be educated enough to know what to do.
I'm not sure that that's the case. That's the case today. I'm not sure that that was the case in the ancient world.
Well, yes, it was. Yeah,
I don't know
Jewish
that.
Jewish merchants who traveled.
Yes, but I don't. I agree. I don't know that the Jewish merchants necessarily saw as a goal that they would be knowledgeable enough to be able to answer their own questions along the way.
No, maybe
the
they
road.
Didn't, but wouldn't the idea of a Jewish education be so that you could deal with the things?
No, I don't think that that was the model that was seen then. The model that was seen then was that you knew what to do, pretty much, because you had seen what to do. I mean, pretty much,
right.
Education was not formal, it was mimetic. You learned what to do because you saw it. You learned how to keep Shabbos because you saw it at home. Now, at such a point that you got to where you had to have recourse to a question because some complex issue came up, chances are you weren't even asking the question. Notice all the players in the story are all chachamim; they're not laymen; they're all chachamim,
right.
And they're coming up and saying, "This is how I understand the halacha. This is how he understands the halacha." We're getting to that right now. Exactly, we did that this morning. We're getting to that right now in the next piece. But the interest here is that what ultimately is going to determine what the halakha is. So the way Rav Yossi is describing it is, it was a no-brainer until now, because everybody had a tradition. If there was something that had been lost in the tradition or was new, the two things Jeff mentioned in the beginning, then they would ultimately go up to the highest Beit Din, whatever they would decide, that was it, and there's nothing to talk about. There's nothing about Shabbat, Beit Hillel. It's just one rule. But that's been lost. But why has it been lost? Meaning, why? Just the fact that you have students who Rav Yossi claims have not studied diligently enough, why did that break up the system? So now look at the next piece, which is what Avraham was directing us to. You take a look at Masachet Eruvin, Daf Yod Gimel, source number 2. Amar Rabbi Abba Amar Shmuel. So this now is a statement of Shmuel's, who is a good 50 years after Rabbi Yossi, and in Bavel, Shalosh Shanim Nachlaku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. For 3 years they disagreed. Now, Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, how long did those schools last? And just for a moment, let's step back and say, what do we mean when we say schools? We say Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, what do we mean? We mean a big building that says Hillel, Harkam Hebrew Academy. What?
Followers,
and where would they meet? And how often would they meet? The truth is, we don't know. We don't know. We don't know if it meant that there were people who were devoted students who would sit there for 12 months a year and be studying, like enrolled in a school, a full year of study for X amount of years, and then would become the teachers in that community. Or if it means that there was a school that had people coming in for a month at a time or 2 months at a time, or when it wasn't harvest season, like Rava says to his students, right? It's unclear. But there were clearly people who were drawn to this school, whatever it may mean, of Shammai, people drawn to the school of Hillel. And at some point during this period, which we're going to call roughly 60 years, between around the year 10 and around the year 70, because by the time of the Churban, there's no more Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. We don't hear about them anymore. So at some point during that time, and we'd have to assume it's probably late in the period, Shalosh Shanim Nechalku Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, for 3 years they disagreed. About what? Watch this. Halalu umrim halacha kemoteinu, halalu umrim halacha kemoteinu. What does that mean? What was Beit Shammai saying for 3 years and Beit Hillel saying the opposite? What? About what? About everything.
Yeah.
Meaning that we are the ones who have the proper understanding of halacha. It wasn't halacha kemoteinu about botsrin lagat, or about notlim liyadayim v'charkach v'chabdina tavayit. It was halacha kemoteinu all over. We are the ones. Which means, by the way, now picking up what Rabbi Yossi says, each school is saying we're the ones who now should be recognized as the ultimate authority. Who then for we know machalokah. But if you have two groups who are somewhat balanced in their influence and both claiming to have the tradition, you have machalokah and you have shtei torot. So how does it get resolved? God steps in. And this flies directly in the face of the first sugya that we studied in this whole series, which is Rabbi Eliezer and Lo HaShemayim. Right? Watch what happens. Yatz'am bat kol. So bat kol comes out, v'yamra, elu va'elu divrei Elohim chayim hen. Both these, the words of Beit Hillel, these, the words of Beit Shammai, are the words of the living God. Which, of course, is what every middle school student hates to hear. right? Because whenever you bring a difference of opinion, what's the first thing they ask you? Who's right? Not who do you follow? Who's right? And by the way, they even asked that about Parshanut in Chumash. So who's right? Right? But who we follow in practice is a different question. Right? But God says, as Bat Kol is the shades of Nevuah, that both these and these are the words of the living God, which means they're both divine truth. V'halacha k'beit Hillel, which, by the way, means that we have two conundra. Conundrum number one is, how could two opposite opinions both be God's word? And the second one is, if they're both God's word, then why is halacha k'beit Hillel? By the way, what would be the alternative? Halacha k'beit Shammai, you'd ask the same question. So what would be the alternative? Elu v'elu divrei Elohim chayim hein ve... What's the next line you could say that would be more intellectually pleasing? Do what you want. Column A, column B. They're both God's word. God wants you to keep Shabbat. Beit Shammai is saying a correct way to keep Shabbat. Beit Hillel is saying a correct way to keep Shabbat. Whichever way, you're safe, would be the next conclusion. Instead, halacha k'beit Hillel.
Or they're both wrong and there's a third.
But then it's not divrei chayim hein. Saying, you, how can they both be the Rebbe Chaim and both be wrong?
Just the same way you could pick one and not the other.
No, but saying that the Reisha precludes that. If you didn't have anything else, you could have God come and say, you're both wrong, and the truth is something that I get that. But once the first statement is, Elu Elu Divrei Elohim Chaim Hein, there's no room really to say they're both, quote unquote, wrong. You could say that God says halacha is like a middle path, you know, something else. But, oh, you say, not saying they're wrong, but you're saying. Yeah. They're both rejected. Yeah. That there's a third.
Just the same way Beit Shammai is rejected.
It could be they're both rejected and that there's some third position. And by the way, that does happen in a couple of cases where Beit Shammai says, not actually with Shammai and Hillel. Shammai and Hillel, in the three famous machlokot they have, actually halacha is like neither one of them. It's like some sort of an middle opinion. It's like with the first Mishnah in Nida. So here, the Gemara asks the second question. The Gemara doesn't ask the first question. We're going to look at the mitzvah for that. But the Gemara asks the question, why is it that if they're both divrei Elohim chayim, then why is halacha k'beit Hillel? Now, we don't know what the Gemara's alternative is. Is it should be Beit Shammai? Or it should be do whatever you want? Right? Or there's an... The reality, by the way, is that it is an ad hoc solution, meaning that in every case we say, here we possibly... Because there's a whole host of cases... At least 25 cases where we pass on Beit Shammai, if not over 50, pass on Beit Shammai over Beit Hillel. So it's not in every case Beit Hillel.
Who had more people?
What?
Who had more people?
Yeah. So that becomes part of the thing. And what does more people mean? I'm gonna phrase it three ways. More people can mean more core people. It could mean more occasional people, and it could be more sympathetic people.
Don't you mean more followers?
Right? That's sympathetic. That's the third. Meaning, you could have, when you say Beit Shammai, let's say, for example, that the devoted regular students of Beit Shammai, I'm making this up because we have no information, but let's say the devoted regular students of Beit Shammai are 30, and the occasional students who come for a month at a time or come for the Kalah or whatever it is are 200. And then the people who either live in towns where the Chachamim are from Beit Shammai or who are somehow affiliated with Beit Shammai are 30,000.
Associate members,
right, friends of, right? But you sort of have that. We talked about that months ago when we talked about Rabbi Akiva's students and the number 24,000, this huge number of students, very likely didn't mean students in the institutional sense, but rather in the almost Hasidic sense of followers who therefore followed him and followed his direction and joined Bar Kochba and thus were slaughtered. Okay, so now, the Gemara asks the second question. So since they're both the words of the living God, why did Beit Hillel merit that the halacha should follow them? And by the way, again, remember, this declaration, this establishment that halacha follows Beit Hillel, based on a bat kol, goes directly against the whole story with Rabbi Yeshua. And by the way, Rabbi Yeshua is a devotee of Beit Hillel. And Rabbi Yeshua stands up and says, to Rabbi Eliezer, a student of Beit Shammai, Lova Shamayim he, and the Bat Kol coming down and saying, Halacha Rabbi Eliezer, is ignored. Here, Beit Hillel, at least in this presentation, is given their entire stamp of approval based on a Bat Kol.
It's not a direct contradiction for a couple reasons.
Go ahead.
Firstly, there's no majority here, and so there's no contradiction to the gospel that we're supposed to follow instead of the gospel. And then the other reason is that after the gospel, in the case of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer was wrong, and everybody else was right. He was considered to
what? Rabbi Eliezer is clearly right. God said he's right. He was ruled against.
When they say Lo Bashamayim,
yeah.
Then at that point, Rabbi Eliezer is wrong, and everyone
is wrong. What does wrong mean?
Meaning he's considered to be going against.
Rabbi Eliezer's position has been rejected. He's not wrong. He's certainly not wrong. Nobody's wrong here. There's Divraim Chaim. But Rabbi Eliezer's position has been rejected as the halakha because of the majority.
And what did Rabbi Eliezer do after that?
We did that a couple weeks ago. The whole thing about being thrown in cherem.
So what I'm saying is,
because he stuck to his guns.
What follows after that story is different than what follows here, which is that Beis Shammai.
No, agreed.
About to keep going on practicing the halakha to Beis Shammai.
Did they? That's a good question. We're going to deal with that next week. Whether Beit Shammai really continued doing Beit Shammai stuff. It's not so clear.
Presumably this Batkol came out during the time of the Chorban?
No, this is before the Chorban. Not because there weren't Batkols before or after, because the one in the Rabbi Eliezer story is afterwards, but because there's no Beit Shammai Beit Hillel after the Chorban. This has to be before.
When did this Batkol occur?
I don't have a date or a year, but you know, sometime during before the Chorban. There's no Beit Shammai afterwards. Beit Shammai Beit Hillel don't exist after the Chorban. So if a Batkol comes out and says, Eilu ve'elu d'vareim l'chaim hein, v'alacha ke'beit Hillel, it has to be before the Chorban, otherwise there's nothing to discuss. Right? So take a look.
Who brings down the Batkol?
What?
Who brings down the Batkol? Is that Beit Hillel?
What do you mean, who brings down? Nobody does. A Batkol comes out. Read it. Batkol comes out. They're having a debate, and at some point, I guess, God says, okay, I got to resolve this debate.
But who's reporting that?
Shmuel. Right? So now, this is a fascinating answer, which really speaks to, in a sense, the democratization of the halachic process. I know it sounds bizarre, but if you think about it on a whole other level, it's absolutely accurate. You have all sorts of halachic strictures that people take on that look to be very limiting. People don't do this, people don't eat that, people, et cetera, limit themselves. And you say, why would somebody choose to take that on when halacha doesn't require it? That's what it is. They choose to take it on because they find something about that position attractive. Either they find that lifestyle attractive, they find the person who taught it attractive in the sense of appealing, persuasive something. Ultimately, people end up voting with what position they want to take. And haraya, if you make a gzerah, no matter how well thought out and well worded the gzerah is, and people don't buy it, the gzerah dies. And the best example of that is Shem Menachem. The Mishnah in Avodah Zarah tells us that along with the other decrees that they made about interaction during foodstuffs and stuff with non-Jews, they made a rule against Shem Menachem, oil produced by non-Jews. And they checked from every corner of Israel and found that nobody was keeping it. So they repealed it. All right, so you'll see how that plays out here. Right? So what's the answer? Beit Hillel, not Hillel, Beit Hillel. It's true about Hillel too. Beit Hillel were nochin, easygoing, and aluvin, meaning aluvin really means embarrassed. What it means is people who would not embarrass others, people who were willing to kind of forgo their own kavod, right? Which itself is a wild statement. Halacha, they both have divrei Elohim chayim. And so we have three alternatives. Alternative one is halacha kebeit Hillel. Alternative two is halacha kebeit Shammai. Halacha three is something of a mix. Either each case is dealt with separately, or else, as long as you're following one of them, you're good to go, which next week we're going to see a statement like that. Which is really difficult to understand. See several statements like that in Chazal, that it's a Beit Shammai Hillel, take your choice. All right? But here, why does the Batkol come out in favor of Beit Hillel and say, Halacha kebeit Hillel? Mimnei nochin va'aluvin hayu, they were easygoing, v'shonin divrein v'divrei Beit Shammai. When they would teach their own words and the words of Beit Shammai. V'lo adal shemak timin divrei Beit Shammai l'divrein. They would even put Beit Shammai's words in front of their own. So in other words, a Hillelite was teaching, he would teach and say, Beit Shammai says this, and we say this. Which shows that they were accommodating, that they showed honor to each other, they showed honor to their opposite numbers. Right? Now, by the way, we do not hear that when Beit Shammai taught, they taught differently. We don't hear that Beit Shammai wouldn't recognize Bedillo's words. We don't hear that. So and it all flows together. It seems that the easygoing nature of the students, the fact that students had what we would call good midot, or were kindly or tolerant or whatever you'd say, it's a very strange thing that would lead to the halakha following them. Let me just show you what the Gemara is dealing with. I'm not going to look at this the back page too much today, but there's one thing I want to show you in source number 4, which is the example the Gemara gives. Really, I cut off the Gemara early. The Mishnah tells a story. We're going to go back to this next week. Mishaya rosho v'rubo b'sukkah. So let's say that you are sitting in the sukkah, v'shulchano b'toch habayit, but you're sitting right at the edge of the sukkah, and the sukkah is attached to your house, and your table's in the house. Are you in the sukkah or not? Okay, so now, Beit Shammai poslinu etilam machshirin. I'm machloket. Amrulam beitel Beit Shammai. Now this is one of these. This happens, by the way, a lot in Breitot, but very infrequently in the Mishnah, where we get sort of a back conversation. Beit Hillel says to Beit Shammai, Lo kach haya maaseh, shalchu zignei Beit Shammai v'zignei Beit Hillel, levaker Rabbi Yochanan ben Achorani. He lived in Choron, Mavo Beit Choron, perhaps, in that area, between near Modin. And the elders, meaning the generation of students before us, zignei Beit Hillel Beit Shammai, went to visit Rabbi Yochanan Achorani on Sukkot. They saw him sitting exactly in the circumstance that we're debating about. And they didn't say a thing to him. They didn't say a thing proves that it's valid. Which means Beit Hillel says to Beit Shammai, what are they saying to them? Your position's invalid? What are they actually saying to them? You forgot your own position. You understand that Beit Hillel is saying, our elders, meaning the earlier Beit Hillelites and the early Beit Shammaites, the previous generation, went together to visit a chacham who was sitting in a sukkah in exactly the situation that you guys say is not valid. Invalid, not sitting in a sukkah. Right? And they didn't say a word to him. And their silence implies acquiescence that this is fine. Which means, by the way, Beit Hillel isn't saying to Beit Shammai, you see we're right because we have an ancient tradition. He say, we're right because even you guys admit we're right, and you don't know what your own previous generation knew. Amru lahem Beit Shammai. So Beit Shammai comes back and says, Misham Raya, you can't bring a proof from that story because you don't have the whole story right. Af heim amru lo, he came to mitzvah tzokam, yamecha. That actually, they did say something to him. And you know what they said to him? If this is what you've been doing, you've never filled the mitzvah sukkah. In other words, what's the disagreement? The disagreement is not now who's right, but really, who has an accurate recollection of the previous generation? At least in this case. But notice that the Shmuel maintains, or whoever is telling the story maintains, that this is a Beit Hillel Mishnah. And what happens to the Beit Hillel Mishnah? They first say, Beit Shammai, Poslin, Beit Hillel Machshirin. They first bring Beit Shammai's opinion, then their own, which shows humility and kindness and tolerance. They include the other person's opinion and even put it first. Now, putting it first can work one of two ways. It can show a sign of deference and respect. It can also be a setup, where you put the other person's opinion first so that you can be the last voice in there and get the last word in and knock it down. Well, what we have to see next week, and there's actually more sources as we take a look at, is what actually happened between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, and phrase it in sort of three formats, is, was there ever a resolution that they accepted? Was there ever a point at which it was a column A, column B? Meaning that Beit Hillel says this, Beit Shammai says that. You do what you want. Right? And then the other thing is, how did the actual people interact around issues that were disputed issues? And we have literature on all that. We'll continue to take a look at it because it really is, Beit Shammai Beit Hillel is really the beginning of the rabbinic period. Remember, everything till then is what we call the zugot. And we do not find machloket, the one famous machloket, the exception that proves the rule. And all this process that happens, like Rabbi Yossi records for us, really starts with Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. And from there we come into the full period of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Shmuel, and then Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Meir, etc., all the way to Rabbi, which is rife with machlokot. And then all sorts of issues of how to determine which is the halacha when there's a machloket. Halacha k'Rabbi Michaviro, halacha k'Rabbi Michavirav, who's Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Talmid Chaver, all of these discussions that have to do ultimately with how do you make a decision in the case of Machloket, according to Rabbi Yossi, didn't even exist till Beit Shammai Hillel came along.